1 John chapter 2 will be our first passage. I'm going to open your Bibles there, 1 John 2. So glad you're here. I have so many visitors here, some from various places, some here because of family, some just because you're here. We don't know how you found us. We're just glad that you're here. And for those that are visiting with us, hope you'll keep us on your radar. And the next time you're in town, you can worship with us again. For those in the community, we're certainly glad you've come to be with us. As we just sang, we stand before an awesome God, and there are times we get together and worship Him in a collective manner as He's asked us to, and we'd love for you to be a part of that and join us as we do that. One quick announcement before we begin. It's in the bulletin, but our new quarters for our teachers starts the first Sunday in May, and we are lacking a second and third grade teacher. It's going to be on the quarter will be on the parables and the miracles of Jesus. Incredibly exciting time to teach, and if we'd take advantage of that and take care of that slot. I want to look today. Let's just start right into our lesson. Let's just remind ourselves of worldliness. That's something we constantly have to be on guard of. I asked, just in passing, this was 10, 15 years ago, I don't remember. Happened to be around Joseph Casimir. I don't know how we were together, but I just trying to just pick brains when you're around people like him. So what do you think? What do you think the greatest fear, the greatest danger for the church today? And it wasn't one of those things he said, well, I'll get back with you. Let me tell you tomorrow. No, half a second later, he said worldliness and apathy. He didn't have to think because he had already thought about it. Worldliness and apathy. So let's look at one of those today. It could very well be that Brother Casimir is exactly right. This could be the greatest problem facing the church today. It can certainly be said it's a never-ending problem. The worldly things may change, the worldly avenues of it, but it's always been a problem for God's people. Sadly, it might be that it's an ignored problem. Some of this stuff is not fun to talk about. Sadly, it might not have been preached on as much as it should. Shame on us. And then another problem is that sometimes we just don't notice it because we've gotten so accustomed to it. We don't recognize worldliness anymore. It's just life. And the sad thing is it might be our life. We blended so much and we've accepted and got conditioned to so much that we might not even see it for what it is anymore. So let's just take a real quick today, just a reminder of some of the things that it is. And just before we begin, let's just start with some basics. What are we talking about? What is worldliness? Well, we know the difference between worldly things and spiritual things. Temporary things and eternal things. We get that. Well, that's basically what worldliness is. It's when those temporary worldly things become the focus. It's when they become the emphasis, or maybe we need to say the overemphasis. It's when possessions and interest and the pursuit of those things are the primary things in our life, which means we really can't study worldliness with an impact unless we're willing to self-examine ourselves. Will we be honest enough to see it? Would we be honest enough to admit, I do allow these things to take way too much control? They do have a lot more of my interest and emphasis than they ought. And here's where it really gets confusing. Here's where it really becomes serious. The knee-jerk reaction is to think worldliness is drugs, sex, rock and roll, wine, women, song, these horrible things that we hear about. Worldliness can become my job. Worldliness can become my habit, my hobby, as innocent as that hobby is. Anything of a worldly nature, it doesn't have to be sinful in and of itself. Anything of a worldly nature that takes precedence, anything of a worldly nature that gets the emphasis, that's worldliness. And we need to see it for what it is. We need to see the dangers of it. And what we're going to do today mainly is look at our relationship with it. But before we do, let's just do a real quick, again, we have visitors with us. We want to do just a real quick synopsis of some things. Almost all sin is worldliness. That's why it's such a serious deal. I'm not going to say all of it. There are some things that might not fit that. When you talk about lust of the flesh, can you think of a lust of the flesh that doesn't originate from an earthly standpoint? When you think about lust of the eyes, what is it that we're looking at that gets our attention? Think of a lust of the eye that somehow can't be traced back to a thing of a worldly nature. Pride of life. Maybe there are some things that we can be prideful about, but most of those, trace them back far enough. What is it that gets our haughtiness up? Is it not how good we are at something? Or how much we've attained, or what? It feels good. It tastes good. It looks good. It makes me feel good about myself. You want to spend some time in deep thought? Try to think of a sin that can't somehow be traced back to a worldly nature. That's how serious this topic is. It's got its root in our weaknesses, whatever they are. It's got its root in our stumbling blocks, whatever they are. And it just consumes. That's what worldliness does. Because here's the catch. It does taste good. It does feel good. It is pleasurable. And maybe that's our problem. We try to beat around the bush too much. We don't want to admit that. And we're not helping anybody by not admitting that. Worldly things have a pull. Worldly things have an allure. And when we start biting at that, when we start scratching that itch, it becomes insatiable. And like weeds in a garden or like weeds in a flower bed, it just kind of takes over. There are many people, and we know them by name. There are people that this consuming thing, it's how they decide if they had a good day or not. It's how they decide if they have enjoyed themselves. It's how we measure a happy life, how sad that is. And we can be guilty of it too. So busy in making a living that we don't have a life. And I'm talking about family life. I'm talking about spiritual life. We can be guilty of this. The consuming nature of it can get us. The encompassing nature, it affects everything. Does worldliness affect morals? Does worldliness affect our family, our homes? Does worldliness affect our children and how they view things? It affects everything. It does affect our morals because we live in a world that views morals as a value judgment. The Bible views it as right or wrong. We live in a world that has condemned any teaching of sexual roles, headship, submission. God just tells us how He ordained it. And our kids seeing all this, sucking it up, sucking this little bit up at the lunch table, and this little bit in the locker room, and this little bit on the internet, and worldliness affects us. And worldliness deceives. Like the mirage in the desert, it promises things that it can't deliver. The alcoholic never dreamed they would end up where they got. The drug addict never dreamed they would end up where they got. Christians who have found themselves in affairs never dreamed they would end up where they got. But we get fed this line, and sometimes we suck it down, and like a Pharaoh, we think we're going to take all this stuff with us. We're just going to get all these stuff that we attain, all these worldly things, I'll just have it buried with me. And well, how'd that work out for the Pharaohs? The point is, in this brief introduction, the point is there is a danger to all of this. So what then is the Christian's relationship with the world? Because we live here. As the saying goes, we live in the world. We don't need to be of the world, but we live in it. And that's a nice, trite little phrase that we've all seen quoted in bulletins and whatever. Wonderful. We can quote it. What does it mean? What does it mean to live in this world and yet not become worldly? What are some things, what are some basic elementary principles that we've got to recognize when we look at our relationship with the world? And the first thing is we've got to learn that we can't love it. Are you with me in 1 John chapter 2? Love not the world or the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Let's just start with this underlying principle. That's why it's so important that we saw. Let me just back up. That's why we've got to see this. Because here's the catch. If me and you never, I know we hear it. I know that it's intellectually embedded in us. We've heard it. None of this stuff was new. But until we digest it, until we recognize the validity of it, if we never see that worldliness is sinful, if we never see that worldliness will consume not just us, but our family, it'll consume our morals, if we never see these dangers, we will love worldly things. That's not a possibility, it's an inevitability. If you and I don't see the danger in the things that look good, feel good, and taste good, we will look and we will taste and we will do it. If we don't see the sin in sexual immorality, we will engage in it. If we don't see the dangers, we have no reason not to love it. Look in Colossians chapter 3. The only way we're not going to fall in love with these worldly, temporal, feel-good, taste-good things is that we have to have an attitude and a recognition of what they are. And as we talked about this morning in the earlier lesson, we don't lose sight of the consequences of sin. Without seeing the dangers, we're going to be worldly. So we start with this mindset. Colossians chapter 3, verse 1. If you then being risen with Christ, let me pause. Who's he talking to? Who has risen with Christ? Who was buried with him, rising to newness of life? Who does Romans 6 describe that that is? If you're a Christian in this room, he is addressing us. If you then be risen with Christ, and every Christian in this room has, seek those things that are above, where Christ sits at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things of the earth. Without these two interlocking principles, do not love the world, do not love the things in it. Set your mind on things above, not the stuff down here. If we don't connect those two verses and if they don't become our mindset, set your mind, verse 2, if it doesn't become where our mind is, where our thought is, where our desires are, we will be worldly. The truth is we're all worldly in certain things. We're having to fight it every day. If we never get to the point where if we never get to where we don't love it, eventually we'll stop the fight. We just won't fight temptation very well. We won't worry about it. We'll just let it go. And our role with the world is we are here. God has blessed us and blessed us again. He has blessed us with possessions. He has blessed us with health. He's blessed us with a mind. He has blessed us. He has blessed us. Use them. And use them well. Be thankful. Be appreciative. Be the steward we were put here to be. And understand we will let them go. Understand they will melt with fervent heat. And so we don't put our affection on them. We're not going to try to be the Pharaoh and have our people just bury all the nice little treasures with us. And 2,000 years from now, people can dig us up and say, he must have been a really important person. Well, look at what he had. We're not going to love it. And the truth is, we're not going to like it either. James chapter 4. And maybe here, is getting a little closer to home. There are things in mine and your life that we don't love, but we tolerate. There may be some meals that that people cook and they put it on the table for you and you look at it. It's not your favorite, but you can eat it. Maybe it's not that we don't. The problem maybe not be that we're just in love with the worldly things. It's just that we're friends with it. Friendship infers some things. There are people me and you know. There are people me and you work with. There are people me and you are acquaintances of. There are people me and you are neighbors to. There's people in our life in a lot of realms. And then there are friends. And we all, you know, there may be that so-called best friend, but friends, plural, and our world is full of them. Me and you have friends all over. And the fact that they're a friend infers that there are some common interests. There infers that there's some harmony. Why is it they're such a good friend to you? Because you have things in common. There are people that, again, there are people that we know, and then there are people we are close to. There are people we are in harmony with. James chapter 4, verse 4. You adulteresses. Talk about spiritual adultery, not the physical fact, the physical act of it. But he said, there are Christians who have cheated on me. We know what physical adultery is. There are Christians who have cheated on me. My people who vow to become my wife. That's what Ephesians 5 says the church is. The bride of Christ. You said you were my bride. You said you were going to love me. But you cheated. You adulteresses. Do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? He's up the ante on us a little bit. You turn to 1 John chapter 2. And say, oh, of course I can't love these things. He says you can't be friends with them either. And that's powerful language. Do you not know? It's a rhetorical question, seems to be the point. I know you know this. Do you not know that friendship of the world is enmity with God? Do we think of it in that powerful sense? To be a friend with the war, he says, you are in battle with me. When you join in harmony with them, you are against me. Look at that last phrase. Whosoever. I wonder if that means me. You think that means me? You think that means you? Whosoever, therefore, will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. Too many of us. Okay, you're right. I won't love it, but I'm going to grab its arm and I'll put my hand around it and we're going to walk down the street together. Friendship infers commonality. It's what it means. If I tell you so-and-so is my friend, you know we are close. If you tell me so-and-so is your friend, that tells me something about the relationship. And what's being told here is, James is trying to get the point across to Christians who've forgotten their vow. Forgotten they are already a spouse to somebody. He says, if you're a friend with that, you're an enemy with him. We don't have a commonality with evil. We are not to be in any way, shape, or form an acquaintance or harmony with sinful things. He says, you can love it and you can be friends with it. Look in Titus chapter 2. So now, here's where the rubber meets the road. Turn to Titus chapter 2. We can love it. We can't put our arms around it and be friends. But yet here we are living in it. So what do we do? What's the role? What's the responsibility? Our responsibility is to stay unspotted while living here. If we can get to where It loses its pull. It loses its allure. We see the reality of it. And if we can get the next step where it's not, we don't love it anymore, but we don't really want to be around it. I should have said that earlier. We have acquaintances, we have friends, we have associations, and there are also people you don't want to be around. And if we can see the sin for what it is, we see the worldly dangers for what they are, not only will we not be a friend with it, we don't want to be near it. Look in Titus 2, verse 11. The grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us. What's it teach us? Teaching us that denying ungodly and worldly lust, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present world. Oh, that's all it is, huh? There it is. Oh, if it were that easy. Easy to read. Easy to amen. But God teaches us that we're to live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present world. There's Daniel's helped me get some pictures. I don't want you to think I'm learning how to do computer stuff. I don't know any more than I used to. Daniel helped me get some pictures in here. But it's powerful pictures. I don't know that I've ever put a picture before in a PowerPoint. Y'all know how basic and generic I am. But these were powerful pictures. I first heard about this when I have a friend who spent about 10 years in Portugal preaching outside of Rio. Learned Portuguese. He lived there and immersed himself in the culture. The Amazon rivers, you will know, almost runs the whole continent of South America. And it's in Brazil. I said Portugal. Brazil is what I meant to say. He learned Portuguese because he was living in Brazil. But in Brazil is where the Amazon forms. The Negros River and the Somalo River. I forgot what the other one is. But anyway, there were these two rivers that converge. You've got rivers coming out of Ecuador and Chile and Colombia and Venezuela. And they're converging. And where they meet in Brazil, they call it the meeting of the rivers, the meeting of the waters. I don't know how you say that in Portuguese, but it's called the meeting of the water. But the interesting thing is, the rivers that meet are so different that they don't blend very well. The things that makes them, you go look this up, the things that makes them as they converge, one of the rivers is much colder than the others because it started in a high elevation. So you've got a temperature difference. And another thing that makes them different is you have a speed difference. One is flowing faster. And so think about that. You got a river here, and they meet. But one is cold and one is hot. Or not hot, but warm. One is fast and one is slow. And what you get is, you get that. You get that for miles. Miles. Now, me and you have seen a lot of pictures of the Amazon. You probably have not seen these pictures because you know what happens eventually. What happens eventually is the warm and the cool kind of just blend together. What happens eventually is the fast and the not so fast kind of blend in together. And you get the pictures of the Amazon that me and you see, mostly where it all looks the same. But at the convergence of it, at the meeting of the rivers, you can go look it up and you can see different pictures than this. But when those rivers meet, you know which is which. You know what the Salamos River is, and you know what the Negro River is. And it is clear and it is distinct. And that is what we're supposed to be. There's supposed to be a distinction between us and the world. And me and you can book chapter and verse. Worldliness is dangerous. We're not supposed to love it. We're not supposed to be friends with it. We're supposed to keep ourselves unspotted from it. But just like with the Amazon, over time, and we get conditioned. And the things that used to kind of turn your stomach, you see it so much and you hear it so much. And before you know it, somebody in our family has that, is living like that. And I don't have to tell you because you know. Your problems are my problems. Your issues are my issues. We all deal with this. And what happens is we just blend. And what was distinct and different, and what was once noticeable and different, over time, we just kind of fit in with everybody else. Turn to 1 John 3. So here's what happens. We've been looking at our somewhat how we fit in with the world. How's the world treat us? What's the world see with us? We've looked at our role with the world. Now what about the world's role with us? Well, in a nutshell, they're going to hate us. They're going to hate you. 1 John 3, verse 13. Do not marvel, my brethren. Do not be shocked. Don't have your mind blown away. Marvel not, my brethren, if the world hates you. Jesus teaching his disciples, he said, if the world hated me, it's going to hate you too. If you're living like I lived, if you're teaching what I teach, if you teach what I tell you to teach through the Comforter, they're not going to like it. It's going to sting. Your words are going to hurt them. Your example is going to hurt them because it's going to be so diametrically opposite of what they do. It's going to bring some shame. And by your refusing to join into some things, they're going to recognize that you see it as wrong. They're going to hate you. Don't be surprised. 1 Peter 4. 1 Peter 4. He had made the statement that it's high time that we stop living like we used to live. And then he goes on to talk about drinking parties and all that kind of stuff. He said, that's what you used to do. It's not what we do now. And it's high time to change it. High time to fix it. But then he keeps going. Look in verse 4. Wherein they, the ones that we used to run with, the ones that we used to engage in this stuff with, they think it's strange that you run not with them. What do you mean you're not? You used to go? You used to come? You used to do this with me? You used to be... What changed? They think it's strange that you run not with them to the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you. John says, they're going to hate you. Peter says, they're going to talk about you. Others are not going to understand. And what they don't understand, they're going to think is strange. And they're going to think is the actions of a fanatic, or the actions of a holy roller, or the actions of a goody two shoes, or the actions of a mama's boy. And they're going to ridicule, and they're going to mock. And if we don't get to where we can control the love and the friendship with worldly things, what will happen is, just like the Amazon River, we will blend. We will bow to pressure. We will conform. And all of a sudden, you don't have this orange and brown, the blue and the brown anymore. We just become like them. Turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 12. You may have wondered this morning when we were doing our study of proper fear why we didn't include Ecclesiastes chapter 12. I want to use that here to wrap up and kind of connect the earlier lesson with this one. Let's admit and let's acknowledge and let's appreciate that God knows best. The things that God outlined for us of how to live on this life, it wasn't just to get us to heaven. That's how we get to heaven, but that's not the only thing. How many times in the New Testament, not just in the Sermon on the Mount, but consistently through the through the epistles, blessed are they. And well, we know what beatitudes are. It's happy. The Bible doesn't just tell us how to get to heaven. It teaches us how we can enjoy life now. It teaches us how to be happy here. And if we can let us just acknowledge His way is best and He knows best, the things that He says that leads to happiness here, let that be enough for us. Verse 13 of Ecclesiastes 12, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. You may be a businessman and you're familiar with the phrase, what's the bottom line? Hey, don't go through all the five pages of it. I don't have to tell me the bottom line. That's what Solomon's trying to do. I tasted this. I visited that. I bought this. The whole letter of Ecclesiastes is a man who tried it all. Wisest man, richest man, most powerful man. If it was under the sun, that's a phrase you hear. If it was under the sun, Solomon said, I did it. And you know what the bottom line is? Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God. We talked about that this morning. Proper fear. Fear God and keep His commandments. This is the whole duty of man. There's life. And without this, what's going to happen is we're going to wander through life and there's going to be, you know, what's it about and why am I here? And this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every work into judgment, every secret thing, whether it's good or whether it's evil. We talked this morning, make sure we have a proper fear of the consequences of sin. Make sure we have a proper fear of judgment, because if we're not prepared for that, that is not a pleasant time. And make sure we understand the personal nature of it. Verse 14 again, God will bring every work. That's quite a bit of works, huh? It will bring every secret thing. Well, there's a lot of secret things in our life too. And this is speaking of us. Every work, every secret, every thought. We're studying downstairs in our high school class. We're looking at the seven churches and what Jesus said to those seven churches. And if you remember in chapter 1, when Jesus, before He was shown walking among the candlesticks, He was shown with these piercing eyes, these red glowing eyes. And the idea seems to be is there's nothing that's not open to His sight. He sees, and to all of the seven churches, I know your works. He says, I see it. I know it. I'm aware of it. And what Solomon in all of his wisdom is letting us know is they're going to be called into judgment. Get your songbooks out. Worldliness, serious thing. We're all dealing with it to whatever degree. And as long as we live on this earth, we will have to deal with it. Again, we've heard the phrase, we live in the world, but we're not of the world. Heard it described another way one time. You put a boat in the water and you're just fine. But when the water starts getting in the boat, you got a problem. But we live in this world and we can be just fine because Noah showed us how to do it. That was a pretty evil world. Joseph showed us how to do it. Moses showed us how to do it. And we have an innumerable number of other examples. People who showed us you can live in this world without it consuming us. And that's our work while we're here. If you're not a Christian, Brian led us in a lot of songs about what God did for us. He sent us a lamb. And that lamb was sent to the slaughter. And that lamb bled out. And by grace and mercy, that blood cleanses us from sin. And as we read in Colossians chapter 1, we can rise up in newness of life. Just as He was buried in a rose, we can too. It's called baptism. Let your faith get you to that water. Do it while we stand and sing.